Hey everyone, I'm Andy. Thanks so much. This is amazing that there's so many folks here. I'll sit down if that's cool, everyone. Again, thanks so much for having me here. I've done a couple of these talks in the last few days, and I've usually started them off by asking, before you saw the flyer for this event, had you ever heard, was there anyone in the room that had ever heard of the organization Movement for a New Society? And here, there's a bunch. That's terrific. That's amazing. But what I wanted to specifically point out tonight that I'm really excited about is that there are a number of former members of the organization and people who are close to Movement for a New Society that are here with us tonight. And it's really an honor. I interviewed and talked with only, you know, a good half dozen or so folks from the organization and did a lot of research with some archives and some written materials. So what I want to say is that I don't want to come across as like the expert on Movement for a New Society. I want to give a couple, you know, some sense of what I've learned about the organization and some lessons that I've personally drawn from it for my own political work, and hopefully those will be applicable to some things that people here have been working on. But I also really hope to make some space to hear from and listen to people who are involved in this work, just to the extent that they want to talk about it. So I'll talk for half an hour or so, and then see if there's things that people here want to add or challenge me on or reinterpret or anything like that. And then what we'll do is we'll kind of open it up for broader discussion. All right. So as kind of Harjeet and Jeremy both said, this book, this small little book, for me is part of a much a kind of larger project that I've really been interested in and been involved with for 7-8 years. And that grew out for me of this sense that when we look and study radical movements of the past, it's often hard to find information about some of the most recent organizations, say just a generation before ourselves. The history hasn't been written. One of the kind of political traditions that I come out of and that shaped me and some of my ideas was anarchism. And for anarchism, I think that it's 3 or 4 generations behind, right? So you start looking at books to try and think about, hey, where did these ideas come from? And often a lot of the histories end around World War I. You know, when Emma Goldman was deported, and it was like, that's the end of anarchism until Seattle happened, right? Until 1999. Or it's easy to think that if you just kind of take a quick glance at some info shop shelves. I want to say though, that while this is a talk that's sponsored by the Institute for Anarchist Studies, and it's in this Anarchist Intervention series, I don't want to talk specifically and narrowly just about anarchism. And I want to make clear that Movement for a New Society, the group that I'm going to talk about the most, didn't self-identify as an organization, as an anarchist organization. And that, I think that's important from the outset. A number of members, and I'll get into this more, a number of members drew some inspiration from anarchism. And what I'll be really arguing is that the organization inspired and passed on a lot of tools and ideas to anarchists, but that was the anarchists that came, that were simultaneous with the group and that have come after, right? So I want to talk about an organization that's kind of been an influence and part of a lineage of this history without saying specifically, you know, that this is an anarchist organization, because I think that would be a misrepresentation. So I just wanted to put that forward at the outset. All right, so the next question that I usually have been starting off asking is, have folks in the room ever been part of a political organization that used consensus decision-making processes to make their decisions and move their group forward? A bunch. Has anyone here been involved in kind of affinity group organizing and using spokes councils to have big, mass-scale, direct action campaigns? Kind of shut down a city or blockade a port or something like that, a good number. How about living in collective group houses of activists, a kind of activist co-op house? a bunch of those too. And how many people have been involved in an organization that was chugging along trying to do some work, and then it decided it needed to take a step back and think about issues of sexism or racism or classism that cropped up between members of the group and try to think through how that happened? Who hasn't? Hopefully a lot of people have. So while I think the name Movement for a New Society doesn't ring out as much as some other historical formations on the left, like the Black Panther Party or Students for a Democratic Society or even the Weather Underground, I would argue that many of those kind of practices and forms, which a lot of people have just said have been important, you know, have been something they've taken part in, were in large measure either developed or transmitted from previous generations, kind of developed upon, and definitely in a sense kind of bundled together and presented as a package, as a way of doing politics by Movement for a New Society and by a lot of organizations that had similarities and a lot of affinity with and that were kind of coexisting alongside Movement for a New Society. And what I say in this book is that we're going to get a lot further in our political work now, whatever that is, if we can think, if we have the kind of historical sense and knowledge of where some of these practices came from, of where these practices came from, of the political moment, the kind of the conjuncture that they arose in, what some of these tactics and strategies developed in kind of response to, you know, because a lot of this stuff was developed as a reaction to problems that had developed in movements earlier on. And so my sense is that we can think about them now, and we can think about their usefulness or their shortcomings now better if we have more of a sense of a lineage of you know, when people started adopting some of these practices that today often I think feel common sense. It's just something that, you know, if you're a radical, you're going to use consensus or, you know, various other things that we can talk about. All right. So that's the reason, that's the kind of framing that I took in writing this short history of MNS. Rather than try to be completely comprehensive, I wanted to say, what does this moment in the 70s and 80s tell us about our moment today? All right. So let me tell you a little bit about Movement for a New Society for those of you who didn't live through it and don't know that much about it. MNS was a feminist radical pacifist organization that was founded in 1971 and that existed until 1988. It had chapters or groups in at least a dozen cities and small towns around the United States. The kind of the biggest conglomeration or the hub of the group was in Philadelphia. But there were groups in college towns like Ann Arbor, Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin. There was an active group in Seattle. There was an active group in Tucson, Arizona. The Twin Cities had a thriving group. Baltimore, Savannah, Georgia, Boston, Massachusetts. So really in a bunch of different places, Eugene, Oregon as well. I did say, yes, and in Seattle, absolutely, an active group in Seattle. People estimate that at its height, there are about 300 people involved. But the organization had a lot more people than that come in and out of it over this 17-year time span that it was active. And I would argue that while that's a significant number, it's not a huge number of people, but MNS had a kind of larger effect on social movement activism in the U.S. than those numbers would lead one to expect, because of the ways a lot of the ideas they developed kind of overlapped with and dovetailed with ideas that were important in kind of women's liberation activism and early ecology and anti-nuke activism that was going on at the time, and because of the way that they focused on training and sharing ideas, and that was a big part of the movement, so it really spread out the ideas in a quick and comprehensive way. All right. So where did this group come from? What are they about? Kind of what's the history? What's the lineage? How the heck did a radical pacifist group come to influence anarchism? That might seem strange, I think, to some folks who today read in some anarchist literature very serious and scathing critiques of forms of pacifism and pacifist politics. So books like Ward Churchill's Pacifism as Pathology, or Peter Gelderloos's How Nonviolence Protects the State, all these polemics against nonviolence. But I want to argue that historically there's been a very important strand of anarchism in the U.S., which was an anarchist pacifist strand, which was part of a broader radical pacifist strand, or a movement for revolutionary nonviolence, which I want to situate MNS as part of. Right? So before there was Movement for a New Society, there was a group called a Quaker Action Group. And that was a direct action group of radical Quakers based in Philadelphia, if I understand correctly. Not all Quakers? Okay. You would think that with a name like a Quaker Action Group, but don't judge a book by its cover. But a significant organization that organized some pretty high-profile actions in the mid to late 60s. Some of the people who were involved with this group had come out of civil rights organizing in the South and had worked on the staff of some of the organizations around Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. By the mid-60s, they had started really turning their efforts towards anti-Vietnam War efforts. And one of the kind of flashiest actions they did that got a lot of attention and was very provocative was sending a boat, the Phoenix, loaded with medical supplies on a number of trips that went to both North and South Vietnam. So, an action 20 years before Voices in the Wilderness started sending medical supplies to Iraq during the first Gulf War, but with a kind of similar idea, right, that not only was this kind of direct humanitarian aid, but it was supposed to be a public relations disaster or, kind of image defeat, as the group Retort talks about, for the U.S. government, right? So these were a number of the kind of actions they were involved in, but by the time 1970 or so rolled around, with kind of the cresting of a whole variety of interlocking social movements of the previous decade, people in a Quaker Action Group kind of started expanding their analysis and saying, ending the war in Vietnam is not enough. That's not going to get to the core of the issues. That's not going to be a kind of fundamental transformation. They were looking, as far as I understand, to this kind of broad tradition of radical pacifism or revolutionary nonviolence and looking back to some figures of a generation or two before. People like David Dellinger and Barbara Deming and Bayard Rustin and Ralph DeGia and Bill Sutherland. These were folks who got really active in the World War II period, where some of them were coming out of Christian-oriented organizations that were really influenced by Gandhi. Other people were coming out of anarchist politics, and the anarchist movement split at that time. A lot of folks, under kind of the influence of the famous anarcho-syndicalist Rudolf Rocker, decided that defeating fascism, defeating Hitler and Mussolini, had to be the kind of number one priority, and the only way that was realistically going to happen was to kind of throw some support behind the Allies and the Allied intervention. Other anarchists, though, were really critical of that. They said anarchists have always been opposed to war and to militarism and to imperialism. And they read it again, they read World War II again as an inter-imperialist rivalry. And they had hopes that people in Europe would rise up on their own and take on and overthrow the fascist governments there. And they thought that that was a realistic enough hope that they didn't want to throw their lot in with and support U.S., Great Britain, France, etc. And so there was a small group of anarchist holdouts, and they got thrown in jail for resisting the draft, as did some of these Gandhian pacifists. So this was a really interesting moment because kind of all the war resistors and draft resistors were thrown into a kind of one section of the jail, so as they wouldn't kind of influence and be a negative influence and spread their politics, you know, to the good prisoners who had just, you know, killed someone randomly for money or, you know, whatever it was, right? But that had this influence of them kind of getting together and talking and sharing ideas and really kind of developing their ideas. And they were seeing that the prisons themselves were manifesting all these kind of inequalities and injustices that they saw in the society at large. Number one amongst them, the prisons themselves were segregated, right? The cafeteria in the prison, white prisoners, black prisoners, other prisoners sat separately. The barber shops in the prisons were segregated. So these anarchists and Gandhian pacifists decided to get together and go on strike and try to put out some of these direct action tactics that they'd been learning and seeing coming, streaming in the news from India, right? And what happened was it was actually pretty successful. They stuck with it. They went on hunger strikes. They went on work strikes. It started getting publicity outside the prisons. And they were what started in one of these prisons holding some of these war resistors started spreading to a bunch of other ones. So it had this really exciting effect. And not only were they successful in desegregating some of the prisons and changing some of the policies, like their ability to receive mail, they started really influencing one another's politics. And they were inspired by the possibilities of this type of action. So when they were released at the end of the war, they were like, all right, we're ready to go. We've got a new movement. We've got these new tactics. We're psyched up. And they what they tried to do was start a movement with some organizations like the Committee for Nonviolent Revolution and the Peacemakers Organization. And eventually the Committee for Nonviolent Action, right? So this whole series of groups, and they started putting out magazines like Liberation Magazine being the biggest one. And what were the politics of these groups? Again, it was something that they talked about as revolutionary nonviolence. What they had done was expand the critique of violence and what violence means and what we're talking about when we're talking about violence. So if kind of older pacifists had mainly meant war, we're against war, the kind of senseless slaughter of people for money and land and territory, this new breed said not just war, but the kind of inequalities that we face every day under capitalism and under white supremacy, right? It's violence for some people to be hungry, to be starving, to not be able to work when other people are living in luxury. So that's a form of violence. It's a social violence. It's on a more abstract level, but nonetheless, right? And they would say that that's not happenstance. There's a system that puts that in place and maintains that year after year, generation after generation. And if you try to push and change that system too much, what's going to come out? The bayonet, the gun, the violence of the police, the billy club, the army, etc., right? So there's always a kind of military backup that upholds this more kind of everyday violence. So that's the kind of main idea. And so I give that kind of that little background to come back to this moment of 1970-1971. So this is kind of on, as far as I understand, on the minds of a lot of folks who were in a Quaker Action Group and seeing what was going on in society at large. So they decide they need a broader program than ending the war in Vietnam. And they decided that they would first try to do that by radicalizing the American Friends Service Committee. So they wrote up a proposal to the American Friends Service Committee and said, asked them to adopt this, to vote on it. This is part of what their proposal said. We hope to catalyze a movement for a new society, which will feature a vision of the new society and how to get there, a critical analysis of the American political economic system, a focus on expanding the consciousness and organizing the commitment of the middle class toward fundamental change through nonviolent struggle, often in concert with other change movements. The organization and development of nonviolent revolutionary groups and life centers as bases for sustained struggle on the local as well as the national and international levels, training for nonviolent struggle, and a program rooted in changed lives and changed values. So from the very beginning, you see that this is a complex multifaceted idea or program of what they wanted to embark on. And I think that it's important to kind of keep in mind that there, you can hear that there's this balance that they're looking for between some external work of growing a movement and affecting other people and some internal work that's about changing and reorienting the lives of the participants of the movement themselves to live closer to in accord with the world that they wanted to see in their own lives. And in a sense, that's where the title of the book comes from, the sense that we have to be opposing the old and the negative, and we need to be proposing the new, right, where we want to go. So the AFSC said, thanks very much, that's a lovely proposal, but not going to happen. We're not there. So a Quaker Action Group people said in response, oh, well, I guess we'll do it anyway, right? They had hopes that they could pick some momentum back up from the, you know, these broad mass movements of the 60s, try and bring some of those fragments together, activate some of the younger people coming into college who had, you know, missed the Democratic National Convention in 68 and were a little bit bummed that they were a couple years too late. You know, there was still a lot of energy, and they thought, okay, maybe we can, you know, pull some of these forces together. So they go on recruiting trips around the country. And I write that returning from one such trip, two members, Barrett Lakey and Paul Morrissey, reported that, quote, people were so varied, old people looking for new hope and young people trying not to become cynical. The wholeness of the M&S approach, from analysis to action to community, generated excitement. More and more people are questioning the value of their scattered activities. Fewer and fewer are willing to put off their personal growth until after the revolution. So again, we see these kind of multiple components of what they're looking to do. So let me just say a few things about how they went about doing that. First, they talked about analysis. I've already said quite a bit about this idea of revolutionary nonviolence. But what was really amazing, I think, about M&S is that they were really trying to incorporate a lot of new ideas that were really cropping up in some of the recent movements. So thinking about what feminist analysis meant to old ideas of radical pacifism, thinking about ecology and sustainability, thinking about the relationships between the global north and what we call now the global south. So they called for a de-development of the United States rather than a kind of increasing industrialization of of the countries of the global south. And they did this in a cool way. They had something called macro-analysis seminars. And these were just kind of self-organized study groups. But they were really ambitious and serious study groups where people would compile long lists of things to read. And people would get together for week after week talking about them. And they proceeded in an important fashion, which was analysis of what's going on now, what's screwed up in the world. Next, moving on to a vision of how things could be, how it could be better, some experiments that have been tried in different times and places, and then a third section on strategy. How do we get from here to there to really work out, you know, what types of movement, organizations, and tactics and things like that have worked to deal with these issues? They would write together. They put out a couple books, Moving Towards a New Society, Strategy for a Living Revolution, et cetera. And so I think thinking and analysis was really valued. This idea often rolled over into forms of action, the kind of next part of the program. So that groups would kind of do some research on a specific issue in the world and then think about how to set up a number of affinity groups or kind of networks within the network in different cities to start addressing and dealing with an issue. One of the most famous ones and most successful was the canoe blockades that were set up to stop arms shipments from the U.S. to East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, right? So there was a kind of dictatorship there. U.S. government was trying to arm and support it and maintain it, right, like they're always doing all around the world, continue to do today. And M&S had done some research in their macro analysis seminar, and they decided they were going to stop this. They just weren't going to let these arms get sent. And so they went out in a fleet of canoes to try to block a giant kind of transoceanic ship that was going to bring these arms. The book has some really nice art in it by a woman named Christine Verses. She works with Just Seeds Collective. Do you know them? They put out the Celebrate People's History book posters. And so they're contributing art to this whole series of books. But she made an amazing kind of cut, and you can come and check it out if you want, but trying to represent that canoe blockade. One of the things that was important was that M&S was really recognizing that you can't just do direct action as an end into itself. Direct action is a tactic that's part of broader campaigns that require organizing and bringing other groups in to share your analysis and to move them to take action. So the first time they did this canoe blockade, didn't work. They just got pulled out of the water by the police. But they kept at it and started organizing with a community of immigrants from East Pakistan. And they started organizing with, like, the longshore workers who would be the people loading the boat. Longshore workers weren't ready to go out in canoes themselves, but they did have this principle of respecting a picket line. If a picket line goes up on their docks, they're not going to break the picket line. So M&S worked it out to put a picket line up there. No longshoremen to load the boats, right? So it's this understanding of thinking about where direct action fits in with organizing and building bigger campaigns, all right? That was 72, 73, I think?
Earlier.
Even earlier. 71? 1971. All right, so I wanted to say one more thing about kind of analysis and structure that I skipped over briefly. And this is one place where I think where we can see the influence of previous anarchists on Movement for a New Society, one stream amongst a bunch of other streams. And that was in their organizational form. They're trying to figure out how to kind of make this group happen in a new way, because they're frustrated with some of the return to, like, traditional Leninist party structure that was happening, and these kind of really loose groups that were showing the limits of their effectiveness previously. And one thing that they learned was from one of the founding members, a guy named George Lakey. He had traveled around Europe, and he came across a Dutch group, an anarchist federation in Holland that was called Shalom. And he took two things from them. One was this kind of network structure that they had of small groups that were connected but dispersed around the country, and that tried to organize without a hierarchy. And the other was this kind of dual action project where they were doing some oppositional work, but they were also building a bunch of co-ops and like reading rooms and other proactive institutions. So that was one thing that he shared and tried to bring into the group. And you can see this right away from some of the literature they put out. They had an introductory pamphlet. And this pamphlet declared the group's opposition to, quote, traditional forms of organization, from ITT to the PTA, Parent-Teacher Association, for they exhibit the sexism and authoritarianism that we seek to supplant. Our goals must be incorporated into the way we organize. Thus, the movement we build must be egalitarian and non-centralized. And one of the ways that this, so we see this kind of ends and means. Your means must be in line with the end goal that you seek to create. You can also see, so it's kind of an idea that I think today is often talked about as prefigurative politics. Folks familiar with that term? The first book in the series, Cindy Milstein's Anarchism and Its Aspirations, talks about this idea a lot. So we want to try and create the types of social relationships, the institutions that we want to see kind of affecting society at large in our own movement and in the work we do. It's a kind of principle that has a long tradition in different Christian movements, but also in anarchist movements. So one way that this was kind of worked out, and this moves into this third area of community that was, I think, is big in M&S, was there a key slogan that they wanted to live the revolution now. We believe in living the revolution now. And in a sense, that was a kind of a new way of talking about Gandhi's idea of becoming the change that you want to see. Be the change you want to see. In its early statements, however, M&S was clear that living the revolution served as only one practical aspect of a multi-pronged revolutionary strategy, not an end in itself. They said, we need to simplify and organize our life together so there is time for the confrontations that are needed if the old order is to fall. So in this, there was a big emphasis on building community and building community institutions. All over the country, M&S people built kind of communal living houses. And this happened to the greatest extent in the West Philadelphia neighborhood, where there were dozens and then, you know, I think up to like 20 of these large old Victorian twin houses, three or four stories, six, seven, eight bedroom houses that were full to the gills with radicals, nonviolent revolutionaries. And in the neighborhood, they built a food co-op, they built a credit union, they had an office where they could coordinate the group out of. Eventually, they built New Society Publishers, which is still in existence today, operating out of Vancouver, and a number of other initiatives, one of them being a community watch that would try to take on some of the functions of police. There are a number of rapes that happened in the neighborhood where the movement was developing. And Philadelphia at the time was notorious for its racist police force, right? This guy Rizzo. Right? Rizzo, the guy who bombed the Move house, if people know about that aspect of movement history. So they were trying to say, we don't want this legitimate fear of people being raped to turn into an excuse for the Rizzo police force to send in tons more cops and build support. So they organized themselves and their neighbors into these multiracial teams that would patrol, not with weapons, but with an air horn at the kind of most dangerous hours of the night. And that would do other kinds of work too, like educating the neighbors, and thinking about why the fear was so great, especially amongst, newer residents in the neighborhood, some white folks, in the neighborhood that were really afraid, that they saw that a lot of the fear that was happening in the neighborhood was racial and was racialized, and they wanted to talk through those issues instead of just confronting it, instead of ignoring some of those issues. You want to talk about that?
Just briefly. So actually, the neighborhood used to be an Italian neighborhood, which had a number of elderly people in the neighborhood, and it was becoming multiracial as M&S and the Philadelphia Y Center started. So the block watches that were set up were trying to address some of those, and even one of the things that we put together was a first aid manual to help with people that were being injured on the street because the police were going after whoever was robbing somebody and not taking care of the elderly person who was lying in the street.
Okay. Okay, great. So a kind of first aid function, an educational function, and a kind of group security function. So these are some of the types of programs and proactive things that were happening. And I think it's important, too, that we get back to and we understand this personal growth aspect, which I've heard is an important part. And that could take a number of different forms. For some people, that meant learning to be have more self-confidence in public speaking or kind of working on doing things like yoga. Eventually, for a lot of folks, it involved doing co-counseling or reevaluation counseling. And I think that it also moved and rolled into some of this work of the kind of what we talk about as anti-oppression work or internalized work addressing sexism, racism, classism, homophobia within the movement. So a lot of kind of discussion and thinking about how to unlearn those behaviors and those assumptions amongst the people active in the group. They did things like developing caucuses for women and for men and have men's anti-sexist groups that would not only talk amongst themselves but go out on the streets and kind of soapbox about gender and sexuality. Pretty intense and amazing in Philadelphia in 1971. So a whole range of activities. The last thing I'd say that this sense of these kind of community formations did was it allowed M&S to do a lot of training. A lot of people would come from around the country and even around the world to M&S centers and learn some of these skills. Learn skills like using consensus. Learn strategy, how to, you know, map out strategy for a campaign. How to do direct action. How to start a food co-op. How to have a macro analysis seminar. All these things. So sometimes they'd be like a week or 2 weeks or just a weekend kind of introduction. Sometimes it'd be 6 months or up to a year that people would come and stay and live there.
2 years.
2 year training. Think about that now. When was the last time someone made a 2 year training or you went to one? That's impressive. That blows my mind. And they, and trainers would go out across the country and train people, where they lived as well. So the biggest place where this kind of had a huge impact was in 1976 and 77 in the Seabrook anti-nuclear power demonstrations. People have a sense of that and know about that at all? Some. Okay, so around that time in the mid-70s, there was a big push to develop nuclear power plants as energy providers, not just for weapons, but for electricity generation. And one of the places one of these giant nuclear plants was going to be built was in the New Hampshire town of Seabrook. And there was an organization came together on the East Coast called the Clamshell Alliance that involved a whole group of different folks, including folks around Murray Bookchin, the anarchist Murray Bookchin, who later founded the Institute for Social Ecology, and some of the anarchists in Boston that put out the journal Black Rose, but also a bunch of feminists, ecology folks, and M&S. M&S was sending trainers all over up and down the coast to help people learn how to do some of these direct action tactics, right? So the action was a big success. A couple thousand people showed up in this land that was going to be where the construction site was going to be, and in affinity groups organized kind of sit-down circle blockades. That's kind of what the image on the cover is supposed to signify or represent. You can look at it later. And M&S had a big role in coming up with how to coordinate thousands of activists together because of this really interesting international exchange that happened. According to George Lakey, one of the folks I interviewed, he understands the idea of the Spokes Council organizational form to have come from a Swedish activist that had come to train in the Life Center in West Philadelphia. And he had been participating in anti-Rhodes activism and direct action in Sweden, said, hey, we have this process that works pretty good over there. We call it small to large group decision-making process. Kind of explained it to some of the M&S folks, and they tried to explain it to other clamshell people. It worked really well. They blockaded the space, and 1,400 people got arrested and got thrown in these big armories. In the armories, you know, they didn't know how long they were going to stay there. It ended up being for about 2 weeks. We've got thousands of people spread all over the place, but M&S and certainly other groups as well, you know, but a big factor was these folks who were prepared from all the trainings they'd been doing back in Philadelphia and other places to train people in the armories and turn it into an educational moment and a moment of bonding and unity and discussion. And they help people organize using the small to large group method to make decisions as a whole of the folks who were in these armories. So that it wasn't just like, oh, one person's freaked out and they're going to bet, you know, they're going to accept the plea bargain and leave. But people could kind of decide collectively how they'd have the most bargaining power and strength. We'll leave, we won't leave, we'll only leave if this many people get to go. You know, so-and-so gets to leave first. And they organized dance parties and, you know, just a variety of events that turned this negative moment, this moment of repression, into a moment of organizing and coherence, where when people did get out and they went back across the country to the places they lived, they were like, hell yeah, there's a new movement forming here, anti-nuclear movement. It has these tools, these ways of interacting that are different from that old 60s stuff that we were getting pretty sick of and tired of, and they had a lot of energy. And M&S facilitated that by putting together these kind of resource manuals and other tools and toolkits, right? They had something that was called the Resource Manual for a Living Revolution. And it got called the Monster Manual. because it was thick and it told you how to do just about everything. It gave you lyrics to songs. It gave you the notes so that your radical marching band could play, you know, whatever it was. And they went out and trained people. So the model of the Clamshell Alliance kind of reproduced itself, and the Abalone Alliance and the Northern Sun Alliance, and spread throughout the country. We can see now that that one of the major sectors organizing the anti-World Trade Organization protests here in Seattle in 99 was drawing directly on that legacy, that mode of organizing, and a lot of the assumptions that went along with it, right? So the Direct Action Network, which Chris and I'm sure many other people in this room took part in, had seen that legacy and seen that work in a number of different situations over the next 20 or 30 years. So that's, I think, really fascinating and exciting to talk about here in this place and in this room. All right, so that's the exciting highlight moment, at least in the way that I tell the story of M&S. But M&S isn't here today. It became clear that there were problems and some challenges that would arise within the movement as well. And so I just want to spend a few minutes talking about those and then kind of open it up and hear from some other folks, right? M&S people talk about the fact that there were kind of booms and busts in their organization. People would get excited in a city and start pulling in more people, start building institutions. But then after a year or two, folks would kind of feel like some tension. There'd be some internal issues. There'd be conflicts. There'd be a question of where they should be devoting their energy. And people would start to kind of float away. And then already by about 77, people started to analyze maybe what were some of the problems and challenges that the organization was facing. One thing was that there were at least one member of the group, a woman named Betsy Rosh Gilman, who played an important role and is still active today, was part of the RNC, the RNC Welcoming Committee in 2008 in Twin Cities. She said she started to realize that the group had kind of two kinds of people involved in it. New age hippie flakes and hard-bitten shop floor organizers. And she was exaggerating a bit, and, you know, but she was noting that there was a tension in what people were focusing on and their approach. Maybe people had the same end goal in mind, you know, a shared vision of a new society, but how they were going to get there, there were some major differences. Betsy points to a few things, a few problems that started cropping up in the organization. And I think it's really interesting because I think a lot of groups of this time broke down because they were repressed by the police or they started really fighting amongst themselves over their internal politics and political line, and then they split and split and split. That didn't happen with M&S. In a sense, some of the innovations that they made started to develop their own contradictions. And that, I think, brought up some real challenges to the group. Betsy thinks that you can talk about the decline of M&S. There's kind of four interrelated factors that were important. One was a growing emphasis on lifestyle over strategic organizing. Another was the manner in which members carried out their anti-oppression work. Another was weaknesses in the group's decentralized structure. And a final was a fetishization of the consensus decision-making process. So let me just say a couple things about two of those, that tension between lifestyle and organizing, and a couple words about consensus, and we can get into the rest in conversation if you want. So this was a time when countercultural communes were a big thing. The Back to the Land movement was happening. Right? There was Black Bear, there was Twin Oaks, there was The Farm. There were a lot of movement people that were going and starting kind of intentional communities of their own. George Lakey remembers encountering newcomers to the Philadelphia Life Center in the mid-70s who saw it as another intentional community and, quote, wanted lifestyle to be the leading edge of change, unquote. He had to explain to them that, quote, the cutting edge of M&S's understanding of revolution is not lifestyle change. We think of it like ashrams in Gandhi's ideas, which were base camps for revolution. So what do you do in a base camp for revolution? You get ready to go on the barricades, right? So these communities were meant to kind of create the economic structure and the support networks for going out and building social movements. That was at least one of the main ideas to start with, right? But some other folks were seeing increasingly MNS as this kind of countercultural movement in itself. The progressive called it Quakers gone countercultural. All right, so I argue that MNS's commitments to simple living, its expanding intramovement jargon, and counterculture-derived social norms created a subculture that served to glue members together, but it also threatened to alienate non-members in the broader left and in the public at large. And you start to see an example of this in a letter I dug up in an archive in Madison. There's a woman named Janet Hilliker, who is a long time, at least had been involved for a few years, and she wrote into the kind of internal newsletter, and she wrote, "What responsibility do we have to the many people who are culturally unlike us? Is our aim a new uniform society? Everyone living in communes, working in food co-ops for lower prices, smoking marijuana, practicing nudity and free love, eating vegetarian and changing their last names?" Pretty caustic and a bunch.
It's exaggerated by far.
Okay. Glad to hear that. It took time for members to see that rather than creating a model of the new society, they were establishing one of many possible new lifestyles that grew out of a specific configuration of values that they prioritized. One former member insightfully reflects, A lot of what was defining our culture was our rebellion against white culture. So we were a counterculture, but we were actually counter to white culture. This made MNS's internal culture less appealing and transformative to people of color and some white working class people who had a different relationship to the dominant white middle class culture to begin with. Right? So when you have a counterculture, what is it in a counter to, and kind of what norms get established in that counterculture themselves, and who does that feel welcoming to and understanding to and radical and, you know, a real sense of change to? That was one of the questions that I think starts to get articulated. All right, so then on consensus, let me just say a couple words. Originally, MNS took on consensus. It was a process that had been part of the Quaker tradition. It was pushed by the women's liberation movement at that point as a way to kind of move past kind of ego-driven debate amongst a lot of male leaders in the organization and value discussion, consciousness raising amongst women. And it was also encouraged by a mediation center, personal mediation, that was influential to some early MNS members, right? And so folks adopted it and eventually pretty quickly decided to use it for all the decisions they were going to make, and all the written material they were going to be produced had to be kind of okayed or agreed upon, signed off on by everyone in the group. This became a bit of a challenge considering that the group had chapters or groups in a bunch of different cities. There wasn't the internet at that time. For a long spell in MNS, there weren't speaker phones on telephones. You had long distance charges, remember those, right? And so there were yearly meetings, but between those, debate and discussion had to happen through this kind of internal newsletter. So you'd write something up, put a proposal in the newsletter, circulated around, that would take a month or two. Then people could write in letters and try and debate, some responses in the next newsletter, push it through, see if there's consensus again. So you could take months and months. So what happened was at the beginning when there was a small group of people, the organization was developing a lot of new theory and putting out whole books. But that really slowed down quickly, even to the extent that at the end of the 70s, when they were trying to revise the kind of introductory pamphlet, it took 2 years just to do like a trifold pamphlet with some basic information about the organization. What's that?
The organizational pamphlet 1980.
Awesome. Have the archive with us right here. All right, so I really want to turn this over to these folks. The point that I want to make, I'll make one final point on that issue, is that some of the folks who kind of were talking to me made, I think, what was a really useful point, a couple useful points about consensus. They said they used it for it started out being useful for particular things, trying to cohere a group, trying to push for new ideas, right? But it worked amongst people who had come into the group with some, who are already closely on the same page, that had some kind of shared commitments already. But what happened was eventually consensus, they saw that consensus had a bias towards staying the same. Because the level of unity needed to be so high to do a new thing, take a new direction, try a new strategy. You had to have everyone on board, that very frequently, even if it was a good idea, it wouldn't cut the mustard, it wouldn't pass. And so then you revert back to what you already have. It's not like you revert between, you know, one new idea or another. It's like, okay, we keep going with what we have because we're so tired of, you know, trying to push new ideas. And so that became a problem and a drain, that there was some sense of stasis and the organization couldn't develop as much as it needed to. That's the analysis of a few folks. I couldn't say that that's the analysis of everyone in the group. Wouldn't want to. And then finally, I think it was really interesting. Folks in M&S had never seen consensus process amongst themselves as really part of this prefigurative politics that they were doing. It wasn't necessarily the assumption that in the new society, after the revolution, everyone would make every decision collective, you know, using consensus all the time. That this was a tool that was really useful in certain situations, but that doesn't encompass the entirety of what real, full, radical democratic process might mean. And though I don't think people often say that, I think that often becomes the assumption in a lot of our movements, is we want to be as thoroughly democratic / using consensus as much as possible now, because that's what it will mean. Everything will be decided by consensus. So we can debate whether that's a good idea or not, but it's useful, I think, to know that one of the organizations that was most influential in pushing this idea and popularizing it didn't have that as their kind of initial intent. So just in wrapping up, I think there's a lot of great stuff that we can take now from M&S, and there's some things that we can see kind of moving beyond. This idea of having long-term, kind of coherent, radical organizations that are bigger than the level of affinity groups, that have staying power beyond one action or one project, and that are built around an idea of an analysis and a strategic direction and way of making social change, I think that's needed more than ever. I think this idea that on the one hand we need organizing campaigns that fight for reforms in pursuit of revolution, that is, that are working on making people's lives better as a way of showing them that collective action can improve their lives and then bring them on board into revolutionary movements is important. I think this idea of prefigurative counter-institutions that show us in real life that another world is possible, instead of just saying another world is possible on every banner, that's important, right? For two reasons. It provides some more resources for doing the organizing work, and it produces a vision and a kind of inspiring vision of what we can do, and it starts to draw legitimacy away from these institutions like corporations and the state, you know, who when we have to rely on them, there are a lot of negative consequences to that. So it builds the legitimacy of social change organizations. But what we have to figure out is how to make those two things work together and build on each other to build the movement, rather than pull against one another and make it hard to do both at the same time. I think there's ways to do that, but we've got to be really thoughtful about it. And so doing some of this history, especially history of recent movements, can really give us some insights so we don't keep reinventing the wheels. So if we make mistakes, we make new mistakes, right? So we try, fail, try harder, fail harder, eventually win. All right, thanks. Thanks so much.